and welcome to the Chris Business Hour from the Bear Cave. I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, our first article is written by Andrew Larson. It's titled, 7 years after acquiring Meriden biotech pioneer Sanofi to close facility and exit Connecticut. Paris pharmaceutical giant Sanofi established a Connecticut presence in 2017 when it acquired a poster child of the state's nascent bioscience industry, Protein Sciences Corporation, in a deal valued at $750 million. Now, Sanofi quietly plans to close Protein Sciences' former headquarters at 1000 Research Parkway in Meriden and exit the state by the end of 2024. A Sanofi spokesperson confirmed to the Hartford Business Journal that the company will move its Meriden manufacturing operations to Swiftwater, Pennsylvania, which has a state-of-the-art facility for production of pandemic flu vaccines. The closure is part of a broader effort by Sanofi to consolidate its offices. Protein Sciences, established in 1984, captured national attention in 2013 when it announced that its first-of-a-kind recombinant influenza vaccine made with insect cells in an egg-free process received U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval. The vaccine, called FluBlock, was initially approved for people 18 to 49 years old. The FDA expanded its age indication to all adults 18 and over in 2014. By 2016, FluBlock became available in pre-filled syringes. At the time of the sale, Sanofi said the acquisition allowed it to broaden its flu portfolio with a non-egg-based vaccine. It agreed to make an upfront payment of $650 million and pay up to $100 million upon achievement of certain milestones. Meantime, the CEO of Protein Sciences at the time, Manon M.J. Cox, told the Hartford Business Journal in 2017 that FluBlock would benefit from Sanofi's expertise in the field of influenza vaccines. Cox called the deal the culmination of long-term and recent efforts to establish the firm's products in the global market, saying she was eager to retain an active role at the company. Since the company is being acquired for its technology, if anything, there are going to be more jobs because we have done a lot with a little, Cox said at the time. However, less than a year after the sale closed, Cox left the company. After the sale, Sanofi continued to operate Protein Sciences Lab in Meriden, which employed about 100 people. Now, Sanofi said it plans to sell the 1000 Research Parkway property, which is composed of two buildings spanning about 19,000 square feet. It also leases a third building across the street at 875 Research Parkway. All three sites will close by the end of 2024, the spokesperson said. Sanofi has been consolidating offices over the last several years. According to its 2023 annual report, the company said it seeks to disinvest from sites that are non-core to our business model and that office space rationalization remains an important goal to help us achieve a responsible environmental footprint. In a statement to the Hartford Business Journal, Sanofi said, "We will seek to employ as many of the impacted employees as possible within Sanofi. However, when we do implement changes, there are times that our people are affected. In these events, we provide multiple avenues of support through all transitions." Sanofi also leases 900,000 square feet of newly built office space in East Cambridge, Massachusetts, where it has consolidated a number of facilities from suburban areas, according to the Boston Globe. The company is Massachusetts' largest life sciences employer. Next, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini titled Boutique Hotel and Bistro Planned for Two Historic Downtown Middletown Properties. A New York-based attorney is looking to renovate two historic buildings in the heart of Middletown into hotel space and a restaurant. Peter Brill of the Brill Hospitality Group Incorporated and 11 Soma LLC and 15 Soma LLC has an application into the Middletown Design Review Board and the Planning and Zoning Commission for a special exception permit to create hotel space and a restaurant at 11 and 15 Main Street, South Main Street, excuse me. The 6,500-square-foot building at 11 South Main Street was most recently used as a medical office. The 15 South Main Street property is vacant and has less than 2,000 square feet of space. Each building will undergo extensive renovations and additions, creating an 18-unit hotel at the Mather Douglas House to be known as the Doug Hotel at 11 South Main Street. The building dates back to 1830. The 15 South Main Street property, built in 1700, will become a two-unit hotel with a bistro-style restaurant known as the Pewter House at the Doug. Both buildings are centrally located near downtown and the Wesleyan University campus. The applications will go before the Design Review Board at 6 p.m. on July 10th, followed by a Planning and Zoning Commission public hearing at 7 p.m. Next up from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Eric Casey is titled Fuss & O'Neill Buys Massachusetts Water Engineering Company. Hartford-based engineering firm Fuss & O'Neill has acquired a Franklin, Massachusetts-based company that specializes in water engineering. Fuss & O'Neill said its acquisition of on-site engineering increases its staff to more than 400 employees at its 11 offices throughout New England and New York. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. On-site specializes in water engineering projects related to drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater, providing services including feasibility assessments, wastewater treatment facility upgrades and retrofits, storage tank design, and leak detection surveys. Fuss & O'Neill marked its 100-year anniversary in May by announcing the relocation of its headquarters from Manchester to Hartford. Next up, an article written by David Kraszewski titled Hartford Healthcare Closing Rehab Facility in Cromwell. Hartford Healthcare, or HHC, will close a rehabilitation services facility in Cromwell after the State Office of Health Strategy determined that no certificate of need is required. In a letter to Hartford Healthcare dated July 1st, OHS Commissioner Deidre Gifford states that her agency does not regulate the termination and redistribution of rehab facility services, so no CON or CON is required for the proposal. HHC has asked OHS in May to determine whether a CON was required for it to close its facility at 136 Berlin Road in Cromwell and relocate the services it provides to sites in Meriden, Wallingford, and Wethersfield. The relocation of this service and consolidation into existing practices with ample space will allow for the addition of new providers and expanded access to specialty programs, including sports rehabilitation, currently not available at the Cromwell location, the application stated. Patients served at the Cromwell site will be scheduled to receive rehab services at one of three locations located at 1064 East Main Street in Meriden, 701 North Colony Road in Wallingford, and 1025 Silas Dean Highway in Wethersfield. HHC said it did not expect any change in the patient population served or the payer mix as a result of the relocation. According to the application, the Cromwell site served more than 6,400 patients from more than 31 communities, and that 27% of those patients paid via Medicaid, while another 20.7% used managed Medicare and 16.6% were covered by workers' compensation. HHC had previously filed an application in 2023 to relocate the rehab services from 136 Berlin Road in Cromwell to 6 Progress Drive in Cromwell, but was unable to do that due to significant and cost-prohibitive issues with meeting HVA standards at 6 Progress Drive location. Next up, an article written by Skylar Fraser. Is titled Construction Firms Picked for Connecticut River Bridge Replacement. Construction companies have been picked to replace the bridge connecting Old Saybrook and Old Lyme, Amtrak officials announced this week, paving the way for the project to begin over the next several months. Construction companies Tudor Perini Corporation, based in Los Angeles, and Torrington-based O&G Industries Incorporated were awarded a joint venture construction contract to replace the Connecticut River Bridge, which Amtrak said was originally constructed in 1907. The bridge is used by Amtrak, CT Rail's Shoreline East, and freight trains. The region is part of the Northeast Corridor, which Amtrak said is the country's busiest rail corridor. According to information from Tudor Perini, the $1.3 billion project includes building a two-track movable bridge structure equipped with new track, signal, catenary, I don't know what that is, power, communication, controls, and security features along the Northeast Corridor. In addition to safety upgrades to address the bridge's current structural deficiencies, the project will modernize the bridge by enhancing vertical clearance possible on it and increase speed capabilities for locomotives. Most of the project is funded by a $826.6 million grant from the Federal Railroad Administration through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. The rest of the project is funded by Amtrak and the state, according to project officials. Work for the project is expected to begin in late summer or early fall, according to Tudor Perini, with substantial completion expected in 2031. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by David Krzyzewski is titled Bob's Stores Closing All Stores, Gift Cards Are Good Through July 14th. Bob's Stores, the retailer that was founded in Middletown as Bob's Surplus, announced Monday it will liquidate its inventory and close all of its locations by July 14th. The closings, which include all 10 locations in Connecticut, are part of a Chapter 11 restructuring petition filed in June, the company said. Bob's Stores is owned by SDI Stores, LLC, a subsidiary of Northbrook, Illinois-based Go Digital Media Corp. Group. SDI Stores, which also operates Eastern Mountain Sports, filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy petition in June, the fourth time in history the Bob's Stores chain had sought bankruptcy court protection. In its Chapter 11 petition filed on June 18th, the company states that it owes between 200 and 999 creditors between $50 million and $100 million, while estimating its assets at between $10 million and $50 million. The petition does not say how many employees remain with the company. On June 28th, SDI filed a notice under the Federal Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification, or WARN Act, with the State Department of Labor. A WARN Act notice is required when a company conducts a mass layoff or closing. The notice, signed by SDI President David Barton, states that the company had notified the state on May 21st of a reduction in force at its offices and warehouse in Meriden, which resulted in 150 layoffs, and that the company had filed for bankruptcy protection. The notice also states that since it did not have a court-approved budget to continue operating, it will conduct further layoffs beginning on July 5th. It adds that this layoff will be permanent. The company said in a news release on Tuesday that despite making swift and aggressive changes to its structure and operations, it was unable to secure the finances needed to maintain operations. All of its stores began going out of business sales on June 28th, offering discounts of 30% to 70% off. The company said Hilco Merchant Resources, in a joint venture with Gordon Brothers, will manage the liquidation sales that include all Bob's stores in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island. Connecticut stores are located in Ansonia, Hamden, Manchester, Middletown, Milford, Newington, Simsbury, Southington, Waterbury, and Waterford. Bob's also has 6 locations in Massachusetts, 2 in New York, and 1 each in New Hampshire, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with more after this break.
Oak Hill is Connecticut's largest private provider of services for people with disabilities. We offer a variety of programs such as the Oak Hill Center for Relationship and Sexuality Education, or CRSE. CRSE broadens access to important sexual health information and addresses the vulnerability to sexual abuse experienced by people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We provide learning materials and professional development to individuals, families, caregivers, medical professionals, and educators. Oak Hill offers a series of workbooks that provide detailed relationship and sexual health information for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in English and Spanish. CRSE also offers virtual seminars and personalized professional development opportunities for your team. Oak Hill and CRSE, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
And welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. We'll dive right back into this week's Hartford Business Journal with an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, Atlanta Development Firm Buys Milford Office Building for $4.45 million. In 2007, it sold for $27.1 million. A Milford corporate office building has been sold for more than $4 million to an Atlanta-based redevelopment company. The 169,000-square-foot Great River Corporate Center at 440 Wheeler's Farm Road was sold in June by Milford 440 Wheeler's Farm Road, LLC, to Joffe Paulding 19, LLC, for $4.45 million. The new owners could not be reached for comment, and city officials said there are no land use applications filed for this property. However, the owners are affiliated with Joffe Land Companies, an Atlanta-based land investment, development, and management firm that says it has a portfolio of more than 7,000 acres for residential, commercial, and industrial use, with a value close to $400 million. According to the company website, Joffe acquires land, either fully developed lots, large-scale mixed-use communities, as well as raw and partially developed land, for residential or commercial use. The property sits in an office park zone, but there has been interest in redevelopment projects of surrounding office park buildings, city land use officials said. It's located off the Merritt-Wilbercross Parkway at the intersection with the Milford Connector and 5 miles to the Milford Metro North train station. The 4-story office building sits on 11.8 acres. It dates back to 1988 but was renovated in 2021. In December of 2023, the building was acquired for $7.1 million by DW Commercial Real Estate LLC, which is the controlling entity of Milford 440 Wheeler's Farm Road, according to city and state records. A previous owner, SH Wheeler's Farm Road LLC, bought it for $4.5 million in 2019, according to city records. In 2007, the property sold for $27.1 million. Quite a loss there. Next up, an article written by Andrew Larson titled HNTB Expands Rocky Hill Office to Accommodate a 50% Increase in Staff. HNTB, an infrastructure design firm, has expanded its Connecticut office as the company continues to grow. The employee-owned company, headquartered in Kansas City, recently leased an additional 2,000 square feet of space in an office building at 55 Capitol Boulevard in Rocky Hill. The expansion will accommodate a 50% increase in the number of employees in the Rocky Hill office over the last year, the company said. The expansion also provides more space for collaboration and a centralized location for conference rooms, according to a spokesperson. The Connecticut office has grown significantly in the past few months, said Jacob Aguero, HNTB Connecticut office leader and vice president. We've attracted talent from all over to come work on some of the most critical transportation projects in the state, he said. HNTB said it's seeing increased demand for its services, which include advising on transportation needs, financing, design, construction, community outreach, and ongoing operations. HNTB has been involved in major infrastructure projects in Connecticut, including the Gold Star Memorial Bridge, the Mixmaster Rehabilitation in Waterbury, the Walk Bridge Replacement, Downtown Crossing Initiative in New Haven, as well as providing engineering services for the New Haven-Hartford-Springfield Rail Corridor. HNTB has more than 70 offices across the United States and more than 7,000 employees. Next, an article written by Greg Bordenaro. It's titled, Connecticut's Economic Growth Slows in the First Quarter, Ranks 35th Nationally. Connecticut's economy experienced slower growth in the first quarter of 2024 compared to last year, according to new data from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Real GDP grew 0.7% in Connecticut in the first quarter, which ranked the state 35th in the nation. By comparison, the state recorded 3.1% growth in the fourth quarter of 2023 and 2.1% growth for all of last year, BEA data shows. U.S. first quarter real GDP grew 1.4% according to BEA data. Connecticut experienced the second slowest first quarter growth in New England, ahead of only Maine, which recorded 0.6% growth. Rhode Island led New England with 3% growth. Nationally, real GDP increased in 39 states and the District of Columbia in the first quarter of 2024, with the percent change ranging from 5% in Idaho to -4.2% in South Dakota. The finance and insurance industry led the growth in Connecticut, expanding by 0.61%. Manufacturing took a hit, with durable goods contracting by 0.55% and non-durable goods shrinking by 0.08%. Meanwhile, Connecticut's personal income increased 6.1% in the first quarter to $323.4 billion, up 2.6% from the fourth quarter of 2023, according to the data. New England averaged 6.3% growth in personal income, BEA data shows. Nationally, personal income increased by $396.6 billion, or 7%, during the first quarter. Next up from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Skylar Fraser. It's titled, Home Market Foods Closes on a Purchase of the Former Carla's Pasta Facility. Next, an article written by David Krzyzewski titled, Connecticut Among Three States Chosen to Participate in a Federal Model to Slow Healthcare Cost Growth. Hospitals raise some concerns. The U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, announced on Tuesday that Connecticut is one of three states chosen to participate in a new voluntary total cost care model that seeks to curb the growth of health care costs. The state's Advancing All-Payer Health Equity Approaches and Development Model, or AHEAD model, that's certainly easier to say, also seeks to improve population health and advance health equity. The project will be guided by the state health care cabinet. In addition to Connecticut, Maryland, and Vermont were also selected to participate in the project. CMS said Hawaii will also participate pending satisfaction of certain requirements. For participating in the program, Connecticut will receive $12 million over 5 years to develop and implement the model. Initial funding will support participant recruitment, Medicaid payment model development, a state health equity plan, data alignment and analysis, and additional quality and cost growth benchmark initiatives, the state said. CMS said it selected Connecticut to participate based on a joint application submitted by the State Office of Health Strategy, or OHS, and the State Department of Social Services, or DSS. Governor Ned Lamont has said the award reflects the state's efforts to improve health care. We will now have additional capacity to advance efforts designed to improve outcomes and control costs, he said, adding that those efforts include investing more in primary care, strengthening the links with community programs to address health-related social needs, and exploring opportunities to transform payment models. The Connecticut Hospital Association, or CHA, issued a statement in support of the states participating in the AHEAD model, saying the state's hospitals are aligned with its goals. However, CHA also said it has some concerns. Questions remain as to how the model can achieve these goals if it bases budgets on Medicare and Medicaid payment rates that are nowhere near covering the cost of care, a problem that has contributed to many of the issues this model seeks to correct, the CHA said in a statement. Additionally, the model design rewards the government rather than the communities and local hospitals providing the services and care. If long-term prevention outcomes are achieved and community health and well-being improves over time, the CHA statement said, we will continue working with the Office of Health Strategy on the details of this program, which both CMS and the state have clearly described as voluntary, including ensuring the model does not build off of Medicaid underpayments, they said. And finally, from this week's Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Skylar Fraser titled, Home Market Foods Closes on Purchase of Former Carla's Pasta Facility. Massachusetts-based Home Market Foods has completed its acquisition of the former Carla's Pasta production facility in South Windsor, the company announced on Monday, and plans to invest more than $70 million into the site to expand it while adding hundreds of jobs over several years. Home Market Foods, a food manufacturer and distributor that operates across North America, has purchased 50 Talbot Lane in South Windsor, the site of a 148,083-square-foot food production plant formerly used by Carla's Pasta. The food company, which makes frozen meatballs and other foods such as hot dogs sold at convenience stores and movie theaters, has been exploring the idea of purchasing the property for several months. The sale price of the property was not immediately available, but it is appraised at $15.96 million and sold for $13 million in 2021. It was listed for sale in late 2023 without an asking price. The company said it plans to invest more than $70 million into the facility over the next 18 months, including a 28,000 square foot addition. By the end of 2027, Home Market Foods expects 210 new jobs created to operate the facility. The building is expected to reopen in June of 2025, the company said. In May, quasi-public agency CT Innovations approved a tax incentive for Home Market Foods expansion valued at up to $700,000. The parent company of Carla's Pasta, Tribe 9 Foods, acquired the company through a bankruptcy auction in 2021. Carla's Pasta filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in February of 2021, citing tens of millions of dollars in debt and the adverse impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on its sales. We'll now move to the Thursday, July 4th, Happy July 4th, New York Times business section, starting with the business roundup. First article in the roundup: if not President Biden, then who? The Biden campaign's attempts to soothe panicked Democrats and donors after the president's calamitous debate appear to have cratered. One Democratic lawmaker has openly called on President Biden to withdraw from the race, while others are sharply criticizing his campaign's response. Polls show his approval ratings are falling, and many party backers remain as nervous about sticking with him as they were last week, but also worry about the alternative. Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas became the first sitting Democrat to demand that Biden step aside. And some Biden allies qualified their post-debate defenses. Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina told The Hill on News Nation, "I think that the American people want an explanation." Barack Obama has said privately that Biden's already tough fight has gotten harder, according to the Washington Post. Democrats and foreign allies worry that Biden has increasingly seemed confused or listless, The Times reports. And 75% of respondents in a new CNN poll said they would prefer someone else atop the Democratic ticket. Team Biden was continuing to try to tamp down concerns with the president scheduled for an interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos. The White House was also weighing Biden visiting Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in the coming days. More crucially, it was also planning a meeting on Wednesday with Democratic governors after they expressed concern about the Biden camp's debate response. Biden told donors at a fundraiser on Tuesday that a recent grueling travel itinerary contributed to him falling asleep on stage, adding that was not an excuse but an explanation. Talk about Vice President Kamala Harris as the most viable plan B is growing, even if forcing Biden to step aside remains exceedingly difficult. Other potential candidates have been mentioned, including Governor Gavin Newsom of California and Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. Like Harris, all have publicly backed Biden. But Harris is the leading alternative. One reason is money. She is the only potential candidate who could directly assume the Biden campaign's $240 million in fund, since she's his running mate. Anyone else would face significant challenges in taking over that money with only months to go before the election. Moreover, the CNN polls showed Harris performing better against Trump than her boss. Key Democratic officials, including Clyburn, said they would back her if she became the nominee. Ann Harris has a coterie of well-heeled supporters, including Brad Karp, the chair of the Wall Street law firm Paul Weiss, John Hens, the CEO of C Street Advisory Group, and Donna Langley, the chair of NBC Universal. Yet some in the donor class have doubts about Harris. The tech mogul, Reid Hoffman, was among her biggest donors in the last election cycle. But Semaphore reports that his top political advisor, Dimitri Melhorn, told backers of the Super PAC American Bridge that switching to the vice president would drive away crucial undecided voters. Kamala Harris is more threatening to those swing voters than a dead Joe Biden or a comatose Joe Biden, Melhorn said. And the lawyer John Morgan told the Times that a scramble for a Plan B could cause more infighting and do more harm than good. For short, what's happening stories in the business world. First, Tesla shares rally on better-than-expected vehicle delivery numbers. The electric car maker's stock was up in pre-market trading on Wednesday and jumped 10% on Tuesday after it reported vehicle shipments that exceeded analyst forecasts. But a questionnaire by the Times suggests that Elon Musk's divisive political views may be weighing on Tesla sales. Next, sentencing in Donald Trump's Manhattan hush money case is delayed. The presiding judge in the case agreed to postpone the matter to September 18th from July 11th to consider how a recent Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity affects the conviction. Separately, Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City mayor and Trump confidant, was disbarred in New York over his role in trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. And our third short article, Apple will reportedly get an observer role on OpenAI's board. Phil Schiller, the head of the tech giant's App Store, will get a non-voting position as part of the deal to bring ChatGPT to iPhones, iPads, and Macs, according to Bloomberg. Microsoft, an investor in OpenAI and a sometime Apple rival, already holds a similar seat, posing potential complications. And the FDA approves Eli Lilly's new Alzheimer's drug. The pharmaceutical company's donanemab, one of a new class of treatments for the disease, was shown to moderately slow the rate of cognitive decline in patients. Its list price is $32,000 for a year's course. But shares in Lilly fell after President Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, called out the company over the high cost of its weight loss treatment, Mounjaro. And our next article in the Business Roundup, Paramount and Skydance, the final chapter. The summer's biggest Hollywood blockbuster may finally be nearing its conclusion. Sherry Redstone has reached a preliminary deal to sell her controlling stake in Paramount to David Ellison's Skydance weeks after talks broke down at the last minute, DealBook's Lauren Hirsch and The Times' Ben Millen report. The big question now, will the new deal stick? A recap of the most torturous media deal in recent history. After months of discussions, Paramount and Skydance, the film studio behind Top Gun Maverick, closed in on a deal last month. Skydance would buy National Amusements, the holding company through which Redstone controls Paramount, and then merge with Paramount. But just as a special committee of Paramount directors was set to vote on the deal, lawyers for National Amusements emailed them to say it was ending the talks. Paramount was preparing to go it alone. The company outlined what that might look like after the Skydance deal fell apart. But investors were unconvinced. Paramount shares have fallen more than 16% over the past month. Media watchers criticize Paramount, which owns CBS, MTV, and Nickelodeon, for its relatively late start on streaming and missed opportunities, including selling trophy assets like Showtime and BET. It's also saddled with about $14 billion in debt. The Skydance Paramount talks picked back up soon after the original deal fell apart. Here's what's under discussion this time. 1. Skydance has agreed to pay slightly more for National Amusements, $1.75 billion rather than $1.7 billion. 2. The new deal will give National Amusements more protection against potential shareholder lawsuits. That was a key sticking point in the earlier negotiations. Non-Redstone shareholders worried that their stakes could be diluted. And third, Paramount is expected to secure a 45-day go-shop period during which it can talk to other suitors. Those interested in buying National Amusements include Barry Diller's IAC, Edgar Bronfman Jr. and Bain Capital, and Steve Paul, the Hollywood executive behind Baby Geniuses. It's now up to Paramount's special committee. Last time, Redstone killed the deal before it got to a vote. This time, she's sending the directors a deal she's already blessed. Next, from the Business Roundup, a look ahead to Friday's jobs report. The S&P 500 notched its 32nd record of the year on Tuesday, but the rally wasn't fueled by the euphoria about artificial intelligence that has sent markets soaring in recent months. Instead, it was down to Jay Powell. At the European Central Bank's annual summit in Sintra, Portugal, the Fed chair said that inflation appears to be in retreat. But he added, what we'd like to see is more data to reinforce that view before making a call on when to start cutting interest rates. The next big piece of data comes on Friday. The June jobs report is expected to show a significant tail off in hiring. Will that be enough evidence for the central bank to lower borrowing costs before Election Day? The markets seem to think so. Futures traders on Wednesday were pricing in a 75% chance of a rate cut at the September meeting. That's even as Powell himself cautioned on Tuesday that he wasn't going to be landing on any specific date. Here's what the economists expect to see in the jobs report. 1. They think employers added 190,000 jobs, down from the 272,000 reported in May's blockbuster report. 2. That would mean a 42nd consecutive month of labor market expansion, keeping the unemployment rate at 4%. And 3. Hourly earnings are expected to have risen by 3.9% on an annualized basis, also below the May number. There's a big focus will be on wage growth. There are indications that pay gains have steadily eased this year, helping to slow inflation. That may be because workers appear to be more content to stick with their employers, Bank of America economists said in a research note last week. In a sign that the frenetic job switching defined by the Great Resignation era has been replaced by a more fixed period that economists are calling the Great Hesitation. And down rounds are on the up. A moribund IPO and M&A market and high interest rates have put a cap on skyrocketing valuations, even as investors line up for a piece of hot artificial intelligence startups like OpenAI, Mistral, and Anthropic. But in this difficult environment, raising money at a flat or lower implied valuation isn't as damaging to a startup's reputation as it once was, and investors are rethinking how they assess a company. Down and flat rounds account for an increasing portion of venture capital deals. This year, they have accounted for about a quarter of all deals compared to about 15% in 2019, according to data from PitchBook, which tracks startups. The reality is that the valuation environment is just very different with 5% interest rates compared to where things were in 2021. Rich Wong, a partner at the venture capital firm Accel, told DealBook, saying, "This is just revaluing the way a successful company might be looked at in the market." Venture capital firms are also feeling the squeeze. Some big names have raised money on a grand scale. Andreessen Horowitz announced in April it had raised $7.2 billion for 5 funds, but many smaller funds are struggling. The number of firms that reach their fundraising goals this year is on track to be the lowest in a decade, according to a recent report from PitchBook. Winter is here for startups, said Venki Ganesan, a partner at Menlo Ventures, adding, "What matters now is just finding safety and riding through the storm." You're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
The American School for the Deaf is committed to preparing students for successful lives in a competitive world. Their transition services program is tailored to meet the student's individual aspirations and post-secondary plans, whether to pursue a college degree, enter the workforce immediately, or find an alternative placement. This service offers career exploration, academic assessments, life skills, and self-advocacy training. Transition programming begins early in middle school and becomes more formal as students move through high school. For more information, visit their website at asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf, always able.
Welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Keith Bradshaw titled, "Europe tells China's car makers, get ready to pay tariffs." The European Union took the next step on Thursday toward collecting new tariffs on Chinese electric cars, telling automakers to obtain guarantees from banks that they would be able to pay the taxes set to be made final in October. The move was expected. The bloc had said on June 12th that it would impose additional tariffs to of 17 to 38% on electric vehicles imported from China. An investigation by the European Union had found what officials in Brussels describe as unfair subsidies by the Chinese government for electric car manufacturers. The Chinese government has denied that it subsidizes the industry. Beijing contends that low prices for electric cars made in China reflect vigorous competition and innovation instead. The two sides began talks on June 22nd to try to resolve the dispute. "We are continuing to engage intensively with China on a mutually acceptable solution," said Valdis Dombrovskis, the EU Trade Commissioner. "The imposition of provisional tariffs requires automakers to provide European countries with financial guarantees of eventual payment, although they do not need to send money yet. The provisional tariffs vary considerably by automaker based on European Union's estimates of the scale of each Chinese manufacturer's government subsidies. The highest tariffs are being imposed on manufacturers that disclose little about their subsidies, including a tariff of 37.6% on SAIC Motor. Lower tariffs apply to BYD at 17.4% and Geely at 19.9%. Automakers will need to guarantee that they will be able to make payment for vehicles that arrive in the European Union starting Friday for a period that runs through October. However, the bloc must still determine in the coming months if the subsidies for Chinese cars have caused significant harm in Europe's car market. Worries are spreading among governments around the world that China is seeking to export its way out of economic difficulty as a housing market crash has made Chinese households less willing to spend. In May, President Biden quadrupled U.S. additional tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles to 100%. Turkey imposed 40% additional tariffs last month on gasoline-powered and hybrid gasoline electric cars imported from China. Turkey had already put additional tariffs last year on China's electric cars. On Tuesday, Canada began a trade investigation that could also lead to tariffs on electric cars from China. Brazil is gradually raising tariffs on electric cars imported from any country starting this month after a surge in imports from China early this year. China has threatened to retaliate against the European Union. Its Ministry of Commerce said on June 17th that it had opened an investigation into whether pork from the European Union was being dumped in China at unfairly low prices. The case could result in tariffs on dozens of products from pork chops to, pickled pig intestines. In January, the Commerce Ministry began a trade case against imports of cognac and other European wine-based spirits that come mainly from France. The French government has been an early supporter of tariffs on electric cars from China. China's car industry has suggested that the ministry impose tariffs on large gasoline-powered cars imported from the European Union if the bloc puts tariffs on electric cars. China has a 40% sales tax on cars and sport utility vehicles with very large gasoline engines, almost all of which are imported from North America or Europe. China also has a basic tariff of 15% on imported cars. Europe has a basic tariff for cars of 10%, and the United States has a 2.5% tariff. The various tariffs now being drafted or imposed are in addition to these basic tariffs. Next up from the New York Times, an article written by Joe Renison and Julie Cresswell. His title, Apartments Could Be the Next Real Estate Business to Struggle. It might seem like a great time to own apartment buildings. For many landlords, it is. Rents have soared in recent years because of housing shortages across much of the country and a bout of severe inflation. But a growing number of rental properties, especially in the South and the Southwest, are in financial distress. Only some have stopped making payments on their mortgages, but analysts worry that as many as 20% of all loans on apartment properties could be at risk of default. Although rents surged during the pandemic, the rise has stalled in recent months. In many parts of the country, rents are starting to fall. Interest rates, ratcheted higher by the Federal Reserve to combat inflation, have made mortgages much more expensive for building owners. And while homes remain scarce in many places, developers may have built too many higher-end apartments in cities that are no longer attracting as many renters as they were in 2021 and 2022, like Houston and Tampa, Florida. These problems haven't yet turned into a crisis because most owners of apartment buildings, known in the real estate industry as multifamily properties, have not fallen behind on loan payments. Only 1.7% of multifamily loans are at least 30 days delinquent, compared with roughly 7% of office loans and around 6% of hotel and retail loans, according to the Commercial Real Estate Finance Council, an industry association whose members include lenders and investors. But many industry groups, rating agencies, and research firms are worried that many more apartment loans could become distressed. Multifamily loans make up a majority of loans newly added to watch lists compiled by industry experts. Multifamily is not coming up and punching you in the nose right now, but it's on everyone's radar, said Lisa Pendergast, executive director at the Real Estate Council. The worries about apartment loans add to the litany of problems facing commercial real estate. Older office buildings are suffering because of the shift to working from home. Hotels are hurting because people are taking fewer business trips. Malls have been losing ground for years to online shopping. The issues facing apartment buildings are varied. In some cases, owners are struggling to fill units and generate enough income. In others, the apartments are full of paying tenants, but owners cannot raise rents fast enough to come up with the cash to cover rising loan payments. As a result, almost one in five multifamily loans is now at risk of becoming delinquent, according to a list maintained by the data provider CredIQ. Analysts are most worried about the roughly one-third of multifamily mortgages that were issued with floating interest rates. Unlike typical fixed-rate mortgages, these loans have required rising payments as interest rates have climbed in the last 2 years. ZMR Capital bought The Reserve, a 982-unit building in Brandon, Florida, near Tampa, at the beginning of 2022. The mortgage on the property was packaged into bonds sold to investors. The property is more than 80% occupied, but interest payments have gone up more than 50% or over $6 million. As a result, the building's owner was unable to repay the mortgage, which came due in April, according to CredIQ's analysis of loan servicing documents. ZMR Capital declined to comment. OWC 182 Holdings, the owner of Oaks of West Chase in Houston, a 182-unit garden-style apartment property consisting of 15 two-story buildings, has failed to make payments on its mortgage since April, largely as a result of steep interest costs, according to CredIQ. Representatives of OWC 182 could not be reached for comment. The spike in rates causing the debt service costs on these properties to surge, said Mike Haas, the chief executive of CredIQ. But even borrowers that secured a fixed-rate mortgage may struggle when they have to refinance their mortgages with loans that carry much higher interest rates. Roughly $250 billion worth of multifamily loans will come due this year, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. With interest rates much higher and rents beginning to decline on average nationwide, if you need to refinance a loan, then you are refinancing into a more expensive environment, said Mark Silverman, a partner and leader of the CMBS Special Servicer Group at the law firm Locke Lord. It's harder to make these buildings profitable, Silverman added. Whereas the debt and loan challenges for offices are focused on buildings in large cities, particularly in the Northeast and on the West Coast, the concerns around multifamily are more concentrated in the Sun Belt. As people increasingly moved to the South and Southwest during the pandemic, developers built apartment complexes to meet expected demand. But in recent months, real estate analysts said the number of people moving to those regions has fallen sharply. In 19 major cities of the Sun Belt, including Miami, Atlanta, Phoenix, and Austin, Texas, 120,000 new apartment units became available in 2019 and were absorbed by 110,000 renters, according to CoStar Group. Last year, those markets had 216,000 new units, but demand slowed to 95,000 renters. In addition, as construction and labor costs rose during the pandemic, developers built more luxury apartment buildings, hoping to attract renters who could pay more. Now, prices and rents for those buildings are falling, analysts at CoStar say. The developers just got so far out of hand, said Jay Leivick, National Director of Multifamily Analytics at CoStar Groups. Everybody thought the demand we saw in 2021 was going to be the way it was going to go forward. That could be a big problem for investors like Tides Equities, a real estate investment firm based in Los Angeles that bet big on multifamily properties in the Sun Belt. Just a few years ago, Tides Equities owned about $2 billion worth of apartment buildings. That figure quickly grew to $6.5 billion. Now, as rents and prices for those apartments fall, the firm is struggling to make loan payments and cover operating expenses, according to CreditIQ. Executives at Tides Equities did not respond to requests for comments. All that said, apartment buildings are likely to be on stronger financial footing than offices, for instance. That's because multifamily units can be financed by lending from the government-backed mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which Congress created to make housing more affordable. If regional banks and large investment banks decide they're not going to be making multifamily loans, then Fannie and Freddie will simply get more of the business, said Lonnie Hendry, the chief product officer for TREP, a commercial real estate data firm. It's a fail-safe that the other asset classes simply do not have. You've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.